So at the end of the day, folks, it looks like some people didn't get to hear our slides. So we're going to start over at the beginning just to make sure that we're all here. So today's session is back due to popular demand. Now we have the summertime. Obviously, it's very important that we typically can tell you that we've never done slides in the summer. We've never had a webinar in the summer. We always take the summers off. But just based on the fact that so many of you have been asking us for information and have asked us so many questions, we figured it's very important that we focus today on plan language 101. Back to the basics. Focus on exactly what it is we want to focus on as it relates to the design of your plan, what's obviously compliant as it relates to healthcare reform, but also important, what's from a cost containment standpoint, what's important. So at the end of the day, today we're going to make sure we focus on a couple different things. One, just understand, this says planned language 101. It's really not 101. This really is a higher level course. I would have to say it's more like a plan language 301. It's advanced level, but we figured that not as many of you would dial in if we didn't do otherwise. So at the end of the day, what we want to make sure you guys all know is that today we're going to be presenting with Jen McCormick, who's here by popular demand, as well as Ron Peck and John Javelin. Chris Aguiar will not be on the actual call. As always, folks, please feel free to contact us at PGC Referral for all of your consulting needs. We average 1,500 different questions every single month. That's a lot of questions every single month that we get. So we figured, you know what? We put this website together. We put this email together. We want all of you to feel free to reach out to us, ask us any questions you have. There's a typical 8-day turnaround in regards to all the questions we get, and we feel that this is a tremendous, this is something that has been needed in the self-insured industry for a very, very long time. Really quickly, folks, I want to make sure that I give a happy birthday shout out to my sister, Anya, who turns 40 today. She's listening to us from Barcelona, Spain. So I want to say I love you to my sister and also say salat to you because she dialed in for the first time ever, and I hope that we do a good job on her behalf. So this is what we're going to focus on. Guys, there's been a lot of recent events. A lot has been happening over the past couple weeks. Lots been happening over the past couple months. So we obviously are aware of what's happening now with the whole gender reassignment issue. A lot of people are coming to us based on what's happening in the news in regards to coverage issues. We're going to touch base on that a little bit today, as well as focus on that a little bit more on our next webinar, which is going to be July 19th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. We're also going to talk about that recent Cigna case, where Cigna is being sued and their self-funded employee benefit plans for a fiduciary breach. We're going to touch base on that as well today and in our next webinar in July. But I want all of you to know what we're going to focus on here is cost containment and compliance. What does that mean? I want you to make sure you look at the word and. There are tens of thousands of ERISA attorneys all across the country that can make your plan document compliant. No question. But it doesn't mean it's going to make your plan cheap. It doesn't mean it's going to save money for your plan. It's going to have nothing, no incentives, no initiatives to find ways to reduce the cost of care. That is why what we talk about is cost containment and compliance. Because a lot of people come to you and go, you can save 40%. You can tie this to Medicare pricing. You can do all these different things. But guess what? It's illegal. Some of the cost containment measures that people come to you with aren't actually compliant with any law. So we feel is, you know what? Let's be crazy here. Let's come up with strategies that are not only can save money for our clients and innovate, but are actually legal. And folks, I can tell you there aren't many attorneys in the country that could do that. So when you look at each one of these items, just remember that each one of these items is tied into how it affects your cost containment strategy as well as compliance. One, the first of which is the definitions. Second is exclusions in your plan. Third is the actual discretion of the plan to make decisions. Think about that Cigna case when I talk about that. Fourth is payable amounts. Next is subrogation, our favorite topic. And last but not least is the in general. It's the catch-all. It's everything we can possibly discuss. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim McCormick. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Chris Aguiar will not be here with us today, but we feel that Jim McCormick is backed by popular demand. People have threatened to never go to our webinars again. They've consistently told us, get rid of Chris, bring back Jen. So Jen, welcome back to this webinar.
I'm so happy to be here. I feel like I'm a guest star on a morning show. So I know that there are a few things that are outlined here on this slide and talk about recent events. And one of the topics that we are talking about today is talking about cost containment and compliance. But where would we be if it wasn't for healthcare reform or Obamacare? Obamacare has brought us the opportunity to offer plans. I'm not sure that I would call it an opportunity, but have required us to make sure that all individuals or as many as possible have access to coverage that is affordable. But in making sure that we are providing accessible coverage that is affordable, we know that healthcare reform has made this happen at a cost. So in order to somehow subsidize this cost or offset this cost, we need to focus on opportunities that we can do this, and we can do this with plan language, as I'm kind of went over some of the different provisions in the plan where we can make changes. But before we get into the actual provisions where we can make these changes, we need to talk about some of the really exciting things that the regulators have put into place for us just in the past couple of months. It has been actually very exciting in the regulatory world with a lot of these changes, a lot of things to pay attention to, a lot of potential changes to our plan documents. So I know that there's just a couple of things listed on here, but I'm really excited to kind of dig into a few of them. So first of all is the circuit split. So I know we're talking about EOB timeframes, but more specifically, we're talking about benefit denials. So just in the first quarter of 2016, there was a case. It was Santana Diaz versus Metropolitan Life. And in this case, the court made a determination about how and what should be on the adverse benefit determinations as it relates to filing a benefits lawsuit, or what would happen outside or in addition to the internal claims and appeals procedures within the document. So right now, we know that ERISA does not specify a limitations period for filing a benefits lawsuit. So whatever the deadline is, it must be determined by the plan document, or if the plan document is silent, it must be determined by any applicable or relevant state law. In this case, in the Santana Diaz case, which was a First Circuit case, the court decided to refuse to enforce a plan-imposed deadline for filing a lawsuit because the deadline was not set forth in the plan's benefit denial, which is important. The court, in making this determination, relied upon the DOL's note that the plan's review procedures and time limits applicable to such procedures, including a statement of the claimant's right to bring a civil action, must be included following an adverse benefit determination. So here, as a result of this case, the first Circuit case, in addition, it aligns with what the Third Circuit says and the Sixth Circuit says, that if you want to comply with what the DOL claims procedures provide, a benefit denial notice must include any plan-imposed limitation period for filing a benefits lawsuit. So if there is no time limit in the benefit denial, it is not enforceable. So if you are in the First, Third, or Sixth Circuit, make sure that you look at your benefit determinations and compare those to the plan document to see whether or not there are any time frames, whether it's a limitation of action provision that outlines how long you have in order to file a benefits lawsuit. And if there is information in the document, it needs to be on the benefit denial. However, in the 9th, 10th, and 11th Circuit, those cases have interpreted the rule to be that the ERISA regulations only require denial letters to include time limits applicable to internal review, so the internal claims and appeals rules. So a time limit in the 9th, 10th, and 11th circuits would still be enforceable even if it wasn't in the benefit denial. So what to do? Regardless of the circuit that you're in, a best practice would be to review your plan to make sure that if you have a limitation of action provision, that would match whatever your benefit determinations say, so that you're not going to have a conflict, and also whatever the circuit that you're in, regardless of where the plan is, that everyone's going to be compliant. There can never be a situation where the court will refuse to enforce whatever the time limitations are because they are not noted on the benefit denial.
So, Jen, we actually just got a question in, and the question is, are there any rules that are relevant to how long you can give plan participants or their attorneys to sue for redress under ERISA? And the answer to that, very basically, is that whatever is reasonable. There's no concrete time limit. It doesn't. The DOL has not come out and said 1 year or 3 years or 5 years, but it really turns on what is reasonable in a given situation, and courts have held different time frames in different cases. There are many courts that have held that 1 year is reasonable, but there are just as many courts that have held that in certain circumstances, 1 year is maybe not reasonable in a given circumstance. So if you would like us to review your time frames, your language, your EOBs, please feel free to send them over, and I hope that answers the question.
Awesome. And also, as far as an industry standard time frame, most have used 3 years as industry standard. So if you're stuck and you want to know what everybody else is doing, everybody else seems to agree that 3 years is reasonable. You can certainly be more aggressive with a shorter time frame if that would be something that would be appropriate for the plan. All right, next, moving along to these new wellness rules. So in May, the EEOC published some final regulations as it relates to the ADA and GINA regulations. So these rules are going to go into effect on the first day of the first plan year that begins January 1, 2017. So we have about 6 months to make sure that we understand these rules, understand the implications of these rules, and how specifically, if at all, they relate to our benefit documents. So the final rules do allow employers to offer incentives for programs that ask questions about an employee's health or include any sort of medical exams, HRAs, or biometric screenings. And in exchange for providing this information, an employer is allowed to offer an incentive. Just make sure that whatever it is that this program is being offered as a wellness plan does not in any way use the information being provided to discriminate. So why do we care? Why do these rules come to be? So as a quick background, there are a lot of conflicting and overlapping regulations about wellness. First, back in the 90s, the ADA was enacted by Congress. Then, subsequent to that, between 1996 and 2010, Congress subsequently enacted HIPAA, and then GINA, and the Affordable Care Act. And all of these different rules have different interpretations and slightly overlap. So we needed these final rules to sort of help us to harmonize what it was that it was HIPAA's goal in order to offer these and allow employers to offer these incentives to encourage individuals to participate in wellness programs. There's been a lot of discussions now about what would be appropriate and what would not be appropriate for a wellness plan. One of the most important things that these wellness rules provide for us is that in order to have a compliant wellness program, the wellness program needs to be voluntary. The EEOC specifically says that our wellness programs need to be voluntary. Well, what does voluntary mean? We didn't know, but now we do know, based on these final rules, that in order to be voluntary, an employer may not deny access to health insurance or benefits if an employee does not participate in the wellness plan. So we cannot hinge eligibility to our health plan based on the wellness rules, the final wellness rules. So if you currently have a document or an eligibility provision that says that in order to be eligible for your health medical plan with employer ABC, you have to participate in an HRA or a biometric screening that is no longer enforceable, that would make the program no longer voluntary. Other things that have come from the final rule that make a wellness program voluntary is that a plan must provide notice that explains the medical information that will be obtained, how it will be used, who will receive it, and the restrictions on disclosure. There are more notice and disclosure requirements that employers are going to have to abide by in order to have a voluntary wellness program. One of the other things that was relevant from these new final wellness rules is they've decided that the reward or the penalty, however you want to look at it, for participation in a wellness program is 30% of the cost of self-only coverage under the major medical plan. So this is different than the HIPAA rule, which was 30% of the coverage that the employee was enrolled in, which could have been family coverage. So now we know it's limited to self-only coverage. So there's a couple of distinctions in these wellness rules, but the most important takeaway from a document's perspective is making sure that you're not hinging eligibility to the plan on your wellness plan. Next, this is a really exciting one. HSS made some non-discrimination rules that somehow impact, well, they do impact, how we should be handling transgender issues in our benefits documents. So also in May of 2016, HHS issued these regulations about non-discrimination practices and activities. Specifically, this rule says that a plan is prohibited from, and this includes a self-funded plan, is prohibited from denying any healthcare-based coverage on gender identity or denying treatment or access to facilities for sex-specific ailments. So the important thing to note about these new HHS rules is, although they seem like they're broad and reaching a ton of different plans, it's a little bit up in the air as to how far the scope of these transgender rules will apply and the types of plans that these will apply to. What we do know is that these rules will apply to any of the exchange plans. We also know that these rules will apply to any sort of benefit that are offered by certain types of employers that receive any sort of federal financial assistance and are engaged in healthcare. An example would be a hospital plan, a health clinic plan, a state Medicaid agency, a community health center plan, maybe a physician's practice, maybe a home health care agency, also maybe a nursing home. So we do know that there are some different types of plans that are related, engaged in healthcare, that may be subject to these new transgender rules. But generally, the consensus is if you have a private sector plan or a private ERISA plan, that these rules generally will not apply. These regulations do generally become effective in a year, in July of 2016. So we need to make sure that, oh, I guess it's this year, so we need to make sure that going forward we identify what type of plan, if we have a plan that would be a hospital healthcare plan, whether or not they are receiving any sort of financial incentives or financial assistance from a federal agency. Also, this rule does somehow impact what it is that must or might need to be covered under the plan. So while they didn't categorically tell us what benefits must specifically be covered as it relates to transgender issues, we do know that there are certain things that are not allowed or are prohibited. So an employer who would be subject to this regulation would be prohibited from categorically excluding or limiting all services that relate to gender transition. This rule does not define health services related to gender transition. So that means that there is going to be an opportunity for discretion to be involved as far as what it is a plan is covering. So we know we can't specifically exclude this. So there might be an opportunity here for a plan that use a little bit of their discretion to make sure that what they are covering is not being covered discriminatorily. So an example of what is meant by these regulations is that if a person who identified as a male was assigned female at birth, that individual can't be denied coverage that would otherwise be available for someone who had ovarian cancer. So it is really meant to offer parity. So someone that may have a gender that they identify, which is different than their birth gender, would still be afforded the type of benefits with the type of gender that they identify with. So since right now this is only a smaller applicability to types of individuals that our plans that this may apply to, HHS has provided that if there is a plan who may not be subject to Section 1557, but that plan somehow does decide or somehow limit benefits in a way that would potentially be discriminatory, that would be referred to the EEOC and they would make a determination or review the case, review the issue to see what would happen next. So stay tuned potentially on possible updates and modifications of how this rule could possibly be expanded. As always, it is important that should a plan be making any sort of changes to their documents to cover or modify the benefits that would be available, that notice of that benefit change is provided as soon as possible, since these rules are provided to us May and they're set to go into effect in July. It is important that we do this as soon as possible, being reasonable. So next on our list is our contraceptive case. So the important thing to remember at the contraceptive case is that unfortunately one of our Supreme Court justices is no longer with us, and that means that there are only 8 judges that are sitting on the court. So when there are 8 judges, there's a possibility that there will be an even split. So that means if a case is referred to the Supreme Court to make a decision, there's not going to be a decision because half the court's going to rule one way and half the court is going to rule another way. Oh my. So we know that a case that recently had been sent to the Supreme Court has been remanded to the lower court. What's important to take away from this case that was remanded is that the Supreme Court is in no way making any judgments, talking at all in any way about the merits of the case, but they're pushing this down to the lower courts to make a decision. So they're trying to ensure or encourage lower courts to come to some sort of decision or compromise about how this should be handled as far as those nonprofit organizations. So we'll see how this kind of plays out, but it's important right now that there is a split and there is a possibility that one circuit, one state may handle something different than the next. And last but not least, all of these things are really important as they relate to our documents. Potential changes are going to have to make, certain things that we're going to have to be on the lookout for. How does this relate to PDM? Well, as it relates to PDM, these benefits, these changes, these modifications, whether it's in the form of a hint or a new benefit option or a new provision, are going to be available in PDM. So all of these changes, as you see them now, the things that we're discussing are going to be part of PDM. One of the benefits of being a PDM subscriber is that you get access to not only all the news and the recent events, but also the provisions that will be changed.
PDM, of course, being the FIA document management software.
Obviously.
I'm suddenly thinking that there may actually be people listening who don't know what PDM is.
I can't.
I know. I can't believe that would be the case either. Just in case for those one or two people who are living under a rock, now you know.
All right. So now that we've gone through some of the recent events, the important recent events, let's start going through the different provisions in the document where we can sprinkle in some sort of cost containment compliance concerns to make sure that we're on the same page. First, importantly, dependents. It drives me crazy when people say they want to cover same-sex marriage under their plan, because there's no such thing as same-sex marriage. Marriage is a marriage is a marriage. So there has been litigation in Supreme Court cases that have decided that regardless of the gender, a marriage is a marriage between any individuals, man or woman, man and man, woman and woman. So in order to have a document that aligns with what the intent of the courts is to make sure that you don't specifically segregate same-sex marriage from opposite-sex marriage. Now, I know that there are still individuals and plans who may disagree with whether or not they have to cover same-sex marriage, but the interpretation, our recommendation, is that a plan cover a spouse, any spouse. It doesn't matter whether it's same-sex or opposite-sex, and in fact that you don't actually distinguish same-sex from opposite-sex within your definition of a spouse. Also, as a result of these broader interpretation of who is allowed to be in a marriage and what a marriage is, what a legal marriage is, a lot of plans have made the decision, since they are opening coverage up to a broader class of individuals, they no longer actually need to cover domestic partners. In the past, coverage for domestic partners was important to include because there was no such thing as a same-sex marriage. So they wanted to afford the opportunity for individuals who are in a committed relationship to cover in the plan. So this may be an opportunity from a cost containment perspective that you want to look at your documents to make sure that, one, they're compliant with how they identify a marriage, and also review whether or not it's still the employer's intent to cover domestic partners, since maybe their objective in covering same-sex domestic partners has been achieved by the now broad classification of marriage. Next, about genetic testing. So I'm going to talk next about the mental health parity rules, because obviously they came out with some new checklists about how we should be handling mental health and certain flags, red flags that we should be looking for. But it's important that if we have genetic testing that's covered in our plan, that whatever it is that is being or required to be tested, that there, if there are pre-certification requirements, that they're not specifically on preventive services. We know that there are some genetic testing screenings that are required as part of the preventive services. So make sure whatever it is that your plan specifically identifies from a genetic testing perspective, that those benefits are being provided for equally to any other benefits. This is also going to be important with mental health parity, that we're not specifically targeting any sort of testing that could relate to a mental health issue and putting pre-certification or authorization requirements on those benefits, but not on other types of benefits. So just in June, just about a couple of weeks ago, the DOL came up with some provisions that they wanted us to take a look at. So mental health parity has been really important. We know from the most recent, or the FAQs back in April, that the agencies discussed methadone maintenance and said that a plan is no longer allowed to discriminate or handle methadone maintenance differently or exclude it because it would fall within the categories of mental health coverage. So you can't have certain limits on methadone that would be non-compliant with other medical or surgical benefits. But a lot of attention has been paid recently to mental health parity. So as a result of that, and the possible discrimination issues and concerns that plans have, the DOL decided to preempt this and offer us some ideas on what things we should red flag. So they didn't specifically tell us that these things should be or would be categorically violative of the mental health parity rules, just that if a plan has these types of provisions or requirements within their documents, that special attention should be paid to them and they should be read within the concert of the rest of the document to make sure it is compliant. So I'll give you just a couple of the flags that the DOL provided to us. The one that I think is the most relevant and not necessarily something that employers would think about is that right now the DOL has said that if you have a fail first, a probability of improvement, or a patient non-compliance provision, that this would be questionable. So if the current plan provides that in order to have this benefit, you need to try this other benefit first and have a fail first provision in the document, that may not be compliant. So you may want to take a look at that specific provision and make sure that whatever it is, whatever categorical restrictions or requirements or pre-authorization provisions that you put on that benefit would somehow be compliant and in parity with any other type of medical or surgical benefits that would fall within that that category. Also, they said that the pre-authorization and pre-service notification requirements should be looked at just to make sure that we are not providing any pre-authorization requirements on admission for certain types of treatment facilities, like possibly a skilled nursing facility under major medical does not have a pre-authorization requirement, but maybe a inpatient facility for mental health does, or a residential treatment facility does. So making sure that the pre-authorization requirements are being provided in parity as well. Also, a written treatment plan has been something that has come up. So if a plan is required to submit a written treatment plan for mental health issues, but not for any medical or surgical benefits, that could be a problem as well. And last but not least, geographical or licensure requirements, just making sure that a plan does not have any special limitations that they are requiring for a mental health provider to do that a medical or a surgical provider does not have to do.
And a real quick addition here, reference-based pricing and claim negotiation was added as one bullet here. Just to touch on one quick point, we get a lot of questions about mental health parity. Mental health parity is, it can be confusing at times. There's a lot to comply with. But we get a lot of questions that say, if we have a mental health claim, if we negotiate it, aren't we paying less for that claim than we might pay for other claims? Well, yeah, it's not about how much you pay. It's about how much the plan actually allows. So if you want to negotiate a claim and pay less, fantastic. The hallmark is whether the patient himself or herself has to field a larger percentage of the bill. So if you're negotiating a claim, fantastic. Lower the bill charges. Just don't lower the planned allowed amount for mental health claims that wouldn't otherwise be for medical or surgical.
Thanks. I know I'm talking to somebody and you guys want to kill me. You give me 2 slides and I take up the entire presentation, but that's okay. I'll shut up shortly after this. Okay, so last, but also this is important, leaves of absence. So this has become relevant and an issue as a result of ADA accommodations. This has been something that may not necessarily have been enforced or necessarily discussed in plans previously. This is actually only coming up because there have been a lot of disability or discrimination-related issues that have been filed or complaints that have been filed with the EEOC. So what did the EEOC do? They decided to release some guidance on us to help clarify what it is that the rules are. So we now know, as a result of this clarification, that a reasonable accommodation of a disability could be a leave of absence. So an employee may request a leave of absence as a form of accommodation for a disability that they might have. That may not necessarily have been the practice in the past with this employer, but now there needs to be the opportunity for an employer to allow this leave of absence. So why does this matter from a document perspective? This matters from a document perspective because not many documents specifically say an ADA leave or an ADA approved leave of absence would be covered or coverage would be extended under those circumstances under the plan document. So it's not in the plan document and it's not allowed, then the stop loss is most certainly not going to reimburse any claims that would occur while that individual is out on an ADA leave of absence or an ADA reasonable accommodation leave. So it's important that this is addressed. This is something that people take a look at, they understand what the rules are as far as what their plan provides, that they have language that accounts for this. We do know that the thing that's important about a leave of absence is that you're saying if someone is looking for a reasonable accommodation, or a leave of absence as an accommodation, what are the rules? What are the specific rules? So we know that it can't be open-ended. So we can only provide a reasonable accommodation or a leave of absence as a reasonable accommodation if there is a point in time which we say this individual is expected to return to work. So it does make it a tiny bit easier for us to draft language that corresponds to this new type of leave.
Thanks, Jen. I'm going to get into just a couple more definitions here. Usual and customary, reasonableness, reasonable and appropriate, maximum payable, whatever term your plan uses to define its payable amount has to be very, very well defined. And we're going to get into a little bit more later about what that actually means in the payable amount section. But I wanted to just make it known that of all the definitions in your plan, one of the most important ones is defining what the plan pays. Because without defining what the plan pays, well, the plan's pretty useless, isn't it? The function of a health plan is to pay health benefits. If the benefits are not clearly defined and if the definition doesn't say exactly what it's going to pay, well, I would say that the document's not as good as the paper it's written on. Next is assignment of benefits. And I'm not going to let Ron talk about this because it's his favorite topic, and we will be here until well into the night. If you've never heard Ron talk about assignment of benefits, oh, you are in for a treat. Feel free to send him an email or two, and he will just talk your ear off. But at the end of the day, assignment of benefits is something that we view as something that has value unto itself. It's not just the dollars paid by the plan that's valuable, but the assignment, the ability of the provider to submit claims to the plan, that in itself has value. So the plan should allow itself the opportunity to revoke or prohibit in the first place the assignment of benefits. Now, obviously, that's not a tactic that is used incredibly often. It's cumbersome, it's complicated, and it cuts the member a gigantic check. And what does the member do with his gigantic check? Well, of course, he pays the provider his bill charges, or he buys a truck. I don't know. And neither does the plan. At that point, though, it's out of the plan's hands. And what the patient wants to do with the money, once the assignment of benefits is revoked, it's up to the patient. But the patient might be balance billed by the provider. Or scratch that, the patient absolutely will be balance billed by the provider, especially if the patient takes the money and puts a down payment on a new house, or buys a truck, or does any other number of things that are more fun than paying that money to providers. Last but not least, in the definition section, experimental and medically necessary. Those are issues that we face on a daily basis, and I know that many of you do as well, especially if you're an MGU or a stop-loss carrier or a plan that works with MGUs or stop-loss carriers. And guess what? It's all of you. Off-label use and drug compounding are two very, very hot topics. Those are things that plans do not identify very well. They don't define them clearly very, very often. And I actually heard someone the other day say that drug compounding is synonymous now with specialty pharma. So, you know, regardless of the fact that drug compounding is certainly not the only issue inherent in specialty pharmacy, it's one of the biggest, and it's certainly a trending hot topic right now. So check your policies, check your plan, see how they deal with off-label use and drug compounding, because if it's not clearly defined, you're going to have gaps in coverage, you're going to have denials, and it's going to be a problem. Another bit of language that we sometimes face is according to standard policies, and that's very frequent in ASO contracts. In other words, the plan documents won't define experimental or medically necessary, but instead, they will say experimental means anything that's experimental as it relates to fill-in-the-blanks standard policies. Well, it's not in the plan document. Yes, there is a way to look it up and to cross-reference those standard policies, but that's about as inefficient as it can be. And if you're presenting the plan document to a medical provider, you're going to get pushback. And they're going to say, well, show me the standard policies. And sadly, what we sometimes see from TPAs is, we don't really have a copy. Well, what that tells us is that, A, you are not making the decisions. You're letting the network or the provider or whoever standard policies it is make those decisions. Often it's one of the large insurers, one of the Blues, Cigna, Aetna, United. Often it's their standard policies, and you know, you'd think that they would be very similar to one another, but you'd be very surprised how much they really differ from one another. Now, stop-loss gaps. I mentioned gaps before, and it's something that becomes very, very relevant when it comes to experimental and medically necessary issues, because stop-loss carriers and MGUs, a lot of them are known for hiring the most conservative vendors out there. So when you have a bill reviewed, it doesn't matter what your reviewer says, stop-loss might come to a different conclusion because they're hiring different vendors.
We received another case just, last week of approximately $1 million in reimbursement that is not coming back from the carrier to this particular plan. It involves two separate brokers. It involves an MGU. It involves a stop-loss carrier. It involves a plan. $1 million, whereas the bottom line, folks, if we got this claim, or received a copy of this policy, this stop-loss policy, back in 2014 when it was signed, for under $1,000, we would have told the plan never to sign this contract in a million years because basically any claim could be not reimbursed. Well, now they're going to spend $15,000 to $20,000 on us trying to get this money back. So again, a lot of stop-loss gaps out there. There are some new MGUs that have entered the market. We've seen some new paper recently, and it's pretty weird when you have people like Jen and John all excited because there's a new stop-loss policy they've never seen before. And they're like, oh, wow, did you see that new policy? I'm like, wow, we've built monsters here when they're actually excited about a new stop-loss policy. Ron?
So speaking of reasons not to pay a claim, let's talk about exclusions. You know, first and foremost, felonies, misdemeanor, infractions, you know, as an attorney, you learn that these words actually mean different things. My concern is that some people think felony is just a fancy word for illegal act. What you don't understand is that most illegal acts that you're thinking of when it comes to claims incurred for some sort of activity, they're probably not felonies. Most incidences of somebody driving under the influence of alcohol, for instance, are not felonies. They're misdemeanors.
So basically what Ron's saying is all through his college and law school experience, he committed many illegal acts.
None of them felonies. I know the difference. And then, you know, another, and this is pretty interesting, is when something's causal versus temporal, one of the issues is that people think because someone is committing an illegal act, all things that are happening during that time are arising from the illegal act, and that's not really true. You know, the example that we sometimes use is if somebody is using, let's say, crack cocaine, and they're smoking crack, walking down the sidewalk, and somebody's installing an air conditioning unit up in an apartment above them, and it slips out the window and it falls and it hits them on the head. Did that have anything to do with their illegal use of drugs? No. You know, versus, let's say, they're using drugs and they overdose. Well, that's obviously caused by the use of drugs. So whereas one is actually caused by the illegal act, another actually occurs during the use of illegal act. And what you'll notice is when you look at these exclusions, some of them actually say claims arising during the commission of an illegal act versus claims arising from the illegal act. So you got to ask yourself, what are you looking to exclude? Everything that happens while you're committing an act or everything that's caused by the illegal act? Another thing when it comes to intent, I honestly think intent comes up more with exclusion than anything else. Maybe it's just because this is where the most controversy tends to come up. Hazardous activities. What is or is not hazardous really depends on the plan, where you're located, what's considered everyday activity in that area. We like to talk about how, Adam, I used to say he does ride his jet ski to work, but you know that's kind of in the past, Adam. I'm sorry. So in the New England states where everybody is on the water, you know, that's not really a hazardous act. Whereas if you talk to somebody who's landlocked, you know, they see Adam scooting around at 80 miles per hour on these waves, and they're thinking that guy's going to kill himself. I'm going to hop on my horse and ride to work so it's safe. But I see a horse, and I'm thinking, man, that thing's going to bite me. So the bottom line is, you know, what is and is not hazardous depends on location. I wish I could tell you that it's simply a matter of just bullet pointing out every single activity you think is hazardous, but there's two issues with that. One, anytime you write an exhaustive list, you run the risk of forgetting something. And two, people are coming up with new ways to hurt themselves every day. So while something may not exist today, it may exist tomorrow. So the key is more to define how you identify a hazardous act and who has the discretionary authority to define those acts. Another item, these are exceptions to exclusions, are things like domestic violence, medical conditions. You know, domestic violence, you tend to see the verbiage out there where it says, you know, a claim is excluded if it arises from an illegal act, unless it's the result of domestic violence. And, you know, we used to have a hypothetical. I think it was someone, remember Mike Sweeney? He was the one in the meeting, great guy, smart kid. He comes up with this hypothetical where somebody breaks their hand beating their spouse, the claims come in to fix the hand, we say, no, that's an illegal act, and they say, yeah, but it arises from domestic violence. We thought that was outlandish, but it proved the point. I kid you not, a few years later, we end up with a claim where a couple spouses were in the midst of a domestic dispute. The husband is chasing the wife out of the house, threatening her with a weapon. She climbs into the car. He reaches in, grabs the wheel. She jams the accelerator and drags him down the street. He's severely injured. As you'd imagine, it ends up being a stop-loss claim. But wait, folks, there's more. The plan, because this person was a VIP at the plan, they decided to interpret the domestic violence exception as requiring them to pay because they wanted an excuse to pay the claims. They pay the claims. They exceed the spec. It goes to stop-loss. Stop-loss denies. It's much easier to get on the same page, look at the language, and understand that the intent behind these exceptions is if you are the victim of domestic violence. And then, of course, we talk about excess. And, you know, this applies here, but it also applies elsewhere. It's easy to just define what an excessive claim is. You know, if you say, hey, a claim which exceeds the usual and customary amount is excessive. Okay, that's nice. What does that mean? It means nothing unless you then say, and we exclude coverage for excessive claims. Oh, that's why it's important to know what success is. So don't just define it. Explain what that actually means for the plan participant and the claims.
All right, contraceptives. Woo-hoo. All right, so I talked about earlier how the case has been remanded. The only thing that I want to note here about contraceptive coverage is that from our recent FAQs, from a cost containment perspective, we know that we now can make sure that we are putting cost restrictions or cost sharing on any sort of more expensive contraceptive drugs, as long as a doctor doesn't tell us otherwise, that the more expensive option would be the one that would be only available for that individual. So that clarifies our opportunity. Instead of just limiting or expanding coverage to all FDA contraceptives, we can limit it to are the less costly ones, as long as there's not an opportunity for a doctor to come and say, for this individual, that a more expensive is the only appropriate option. In that case, we'd have to expand the coverage. Next up, specialty drugs. So we know in general that a plan is permitted to exclude specialty drugs from their plan.
Well, hold on here. This, I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time on this, Jen. A lot of people are asking of us about this, so let's just try to make sure we spend a couple minutes on just what you can do and what are people doing, let's say, that makes some sense financially, but also, you know, making sure they actually have coverage available to their employees if need be.
Right. So generally, we say specialty drugs is a category in and of itself. Can we exclude it? Generally, yes. Are there exceptions to the rule? Absolutely. So a couple of the exceptions. One, we want to make sure that we're not violating any rules. And two, we want to make sure we're not discriminating. One of the issues is with mental health. So as far as mental health is concerned, there are six categories under mental health, which we have to make sure that we're offering medical surgical benefits in parity with mental health and substance abuse. One of those categories is prescription drugs. So if we limit drugs that are specific to mental health parity or substance abuse and require pre-authorization or exclude those specific drugs, then we are creating a discrimination issue, a non-compliance issue with mental health parity. So we can exclude drugs, we have to be careful how we would specifically exclude them. We can't make sure that we are targeting or pulling out a separate category of mental health type drugs or substance abuse type drugs. Next is, in the past we still talk a lot about dialysis and ESRD and what the implications would be, how we can contain costs, how we can look at a plan and maybe limit the cost that an employer would have to incur as it relates to a potential individual who has ESRD. And after reviewing the rules, the Medicare Secondary Payer Act, we realize that you should not target individuals who have ESRD, and the only way that you could really get at this from a neutral perspective across the board is based on the treatment, which is dialysis. So it would be appropriate if we limit coverage for all of dialysis, whether or not the individual has ESRD or not. Another expensive claim issue that has arisen has been individuals who have hemophilia. So there has been some discussion lately with individuals who want to, or plans that want to specifically exclude hemophilia drugs from their plans. Well, hemophilia is a diagnosis, it is not a treatment. So in order to have plan benefits where we are containing costs, you need to make sure that if you are excluding these drugs, that you're not excluding hemophilia drugs, but you're excluding a broad category of drugs or a treatment of drugs, like dialysis is to ESRD, blood clotting or blood clotting factor drugs, however you say it, is similar to how we would handle it for those who have ESRD.
I want to make sure one thing is made clear. We are not here on this webinar trying to tell our clients, this is what you should limit, this is what you should eliminate coverages, make sure the people that have hemophilia don't get coverage or don't have access to drugs. What we're doing basically is we get a lot of questions about it. What we are trying to do as an organization though is ensure that we can offer all the benefits to all the employees of the particular plan. We want to make sure that everybody has all the coverages, and here's how you can still have all the coverages but yet focus on a cost containment feature.
Right.
Because again, I can tell you right now, if we had a hemophiliac on our plan, or if I, as a board member of SIA, one of the things that we don't want to make sure we have out there as a message is, here's how you get hemophiliacs off your plan.
Right. Right.
We're just responding to the 1,500 emails we get every single month and trying to help the industry as a whole as, this is what you can do, here's what you can't do. We would recommend against this, but the last thing we want and what we have seen already is many plans out there literally trying to deny hemophilia,
right,
which we know is just not legal.
Right, and it's certainly not a recommendation. This question has been brought up in the past, so just so we're clear, it's not our, and I also am probably more conservative and the rest of these guys. But it's not my opinion. It's not a recommendation that you specifically say that you're going to be excluding hemophilia individuals or drugs for hemophilia under your plan. But if that is something that you're interested in, we can have further discussions about it.
Thanks, Jen. The issue of discretion now is one that ties into everything we've been talking about. Plan documents are not 3 pages long. They're 100 pages long. In those 100 pages, or even more, I saw one the other day, it was about 160 pages, there are tons of terms. All those terms are defined. Well, hopefully, right? A lot of the terms are not defined, or if they are defined, they are poorly defined. So there's always going to be the need for some interpretive discretion in the plan document. A great example, as Ron talked about, was hazardous activities. The plan cannot conceivably list every activity that could be deemed hazardous. There are tons of contingencies and other factors that might make an otherwise not hazardous activity hazardous. So the plan administrator needs to have some discretion to interpret the plan. And what that comes down to is the standard of review is arbitrary and capricious. If the plan administrator looks at the language and just makes something up off the top of his head, and a court says that there's no way that a reasonable person could have come to that conclusion based on this language, well, that's going to be a problem. The court is going to look at it from scratch. It's called de novo. That's Latin. That's how you know it's important. But if the plan administrator has any reasonable basis in fact for making the determination that has been made, it will be there will be deference from the court. Now, of course, there's no guarantee that the plan administrator's decision will be upheld, but the court will give the plan administrator deference, and they will say, well, you know, it was reasonable, so we're not going to overturn it unless there's a very, very, very compelling reason. Some of the practical effects are, the one that I want to bring up is a conflict of interest. Courts have said that where the plan administrator is the same entity as the plan sponsor, there may be less or no deference in some situations. So for example, or not for example, but to clarify rather, if the person making the decisions is also the person holding the purse strings, the court might look at it and be a little more skeptical and say, well, you know, did you have an ulterior motive for denying this claim? So that is an issue that's dealt with on a case-by-case basis. There's evidence presented from both sides. Someone says there is a conflict. Someone says, no way, there's no conflict. I'm impartial. At the end of the day, though, you may risk losing your discretion, which is actually a great reason to outsource fiduciary duties whenever humanly possible. You eliminate the possibility of a conflict of interest when a neutral party is handling your claims or appeals. Now, some of the limitations on discretion, and there are tons of them, there's a lot of case law over the years. One is the reasonable standard. This ties into the arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion standard. If the plan administrator's discretion was not utilized in a reasonable manner, it's not going to be upheld. Another one is the best interests of the plan and participants. The plan administrator's one is to administer benefits in accordance with the terms of the plan, and the other, overarching one, is to look out for the best interests of the plan and for the participants of the plan.
And that's why you've seen a lot of the litigation recently, is they're not actually doing what's in the best interest of the plan or the participant.
Right. I mean, we see some instances where plan administrators actually do things that are in their own personal best interest.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing worse. another issue is issues of fact versus issues of law. A lot of discretionary language gives the plan administrator to interpret the law. Can't do that. You just can't. All courts say, it's not okay. You can interpret issues of fact because those you can be objective about, but issues of law, those are reserved for the court to issue. Whatever Congress says, it's the court's job.
Ron? All right, let's subrogate. First and foremost, sign subrogation agreements.
Stop it. All right? Plan documents allow you to enforce their terms in accordance with federal law, federal court, all the discretion John just talked about at your disposal. If you go and try to enforce a signed subro agreement, that's a contract enforceable under state law. Basically, with a plan document, you've got a Maserati in the garage, and what you're doing is you're forcing the plan participant to give you a Ford Pinto, and you're driving that instead. Please don't do that.
If there is someone out there that's telling you to still have a signed subrogation form, please email Ron and myself that person's name, phone number, and email, and home address.
Home address.
That is the key.
Listen, I get it. You know, I've got a son at home. He likes his binky. Everyone wants to feel safe. If you need something in writing to satisfy someone, just get something in writing that says they understand the terms of the plan and that they'll comply with
the terms of the plan.
Bingo.
Done.
So, exclusion for third-party liability. This is a line you may not want to cross. I've seen a lot of benefit plans that say they will always exclude claims if there may be third-party liability. Well, here's my question for you. If you fail to exclude a claim and you pay it, aren't you then saying that you've determined there's no third-party liability, and thus can't they use that against you when you try to subrogate? Here's an idea. Why don't you say that you may exclude for third-party liability? However, if you choose to pay in those instances, you have a right to pursue reimbursement after the fact. That covers all the bases. Likewise, you talk about common fund, made whole, these rules. Listen, if you're a self-funded private ERISA plan, federal law preempts state law, all of these rules under state law, common fund, made whole, reduction for attorney's fees, things like that, absolutely you need to disclaim those rules. But even when state law applies, there are some states that will actually allow you to shrink or completely eliminate the impact of these rules, even under state law in certain circumstances. You're much better off disclaiming these rules and say, up to or within the confines of applicable state law. This way, if state law allows it, you've got your bases covered. Same thing with offset. Again, another rule, not always allowed, but you might as well state it as long as it's in compliance with law.
When it comes to offset, folks, just understand, we've had offset language in our clients' employee benefit plans for 16 years. We've actually had a client use offset to obtain a subrogation result one time in 16 years. Having it there, though, it's like a nuclear weapon. You don't actually want to use it, but if they know you have one, they're probably not going to bomb your country. So having the offset is a big piece of our weaponry that we use to enforce our subrogation.
Right. Better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. So plan documents, SPDs. Listen, there was once upon a time when these self-funded plans, they could write a plan document however they chose, and that was it. And then along comes the law that says everybody has to have a uniform SPD that states clearly what all the rules are, and they dictate what needs to be stated in writing. You have to understand, there's no specific law requiring that you have a plan document, just that you have an SPD. But the problem is, how can you have a summary of something if there's no something to summarize? Add to that things like SMMs, SMRs, which are the summary modifications, and pretty soon you've got this entire list of things you need to be issuing that indicate what the plan rules are. The goal is to try and minimize the number of documents out there stating what the plan terms are. We can try to help you contain those into as few documents as possible, the minimum required by law.
Last but not least, for those of you who've not heard about our PACE product or the fiduciary issues that have been happening lately, then get out from under that rock. As many of you know, Cigna has been recently slammed by a federal court with a $13 million judgment, and now over 100 Cigna-administered health plans are being sued for embezzlement health care litigation. Bottom line, folks, is more and more people are starting to look at self-funded employers. Why? We're successful. We're growing. As you get to the top of that mountain, people want to bring you down. Therefore, you need to look at what your plans are doing and then decide, do I want to be the fiduciary or do I want my client to be the fiduciary in these particular stages? Chances are probably not. So if you have an issue, whether it's your SPD or whether it's your fiduciary responsibility, make sure you call us. Okay, we've got 57 questions, the most we've ever received. We would have to do another hour-long webinar, which we will do, July 19, 2016 at 1 o'clock in July. It's our first ever webinar in July. We will do a 201 plan doc session. We will have Jen McCormick back. Because everyone is asking us, please bring back Jen. She is amazing. We will do so. Chris will not join us again.
Actually, Chris has submitted a request that we keep Jen. So
there you go. Right, that's even better. But please join us next month, July 19th. We're excited. And also, if you emailed us a question, a lot of them are repeats, we will make sure we forward those back. No, we will not bring Chris back.
Oh,
stop emailing.
Stop it.
Have a great day, everybody. Thank you. And good